time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 11th of August 2012. Island Life is a weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday, the 11th of August, Jan Scott talked to award-winning olive grower Kerry Hart and Joe Holmes from the Waiheke Local Board.
And it's now my very great pleasure to say good morning to Kerry Hart. Good morning, Kerry.
Good morning, Jan.
Kerry and his wife own...
Bernie
own Azuro Groves in Te Whau Peninsula. They grow olives and they've also got alpacas. But you've learnt some very exciting news this week, Kerry.
Oh, yes. Very excited.
So what's happened?
We entered our olive oils, all three of them, into the Los Angeles International Extra Virgin Olive Oil Competition in LA, and we just were notified that we won Best of Class and also a gold medal for our Reserva Blend oil, and we also won a bronze for our Tuscan Blend. That's a major achievement for us.
Okay, so who are you up against?
The rest of New Zealand. We were the only New Zealand producer to win a gold and also to win Best of Class. So it's great news for us.
Right, but there would have been olive oils there from all over the world?
Yes, there were. When you look at the list of winners, so that's Best of Class, Best of Show, Gold, Silver, Bronze, there's probably 600 or 700 that won awards, but we have no idea how many entered, because there would probably be quite a few that entered and didn't win anything.
But some of these entrants would have been old hands and been doing it for years and probably won before.
Yes, in Australia, the leading brand over there is Cobram Estate, and they won, I think, one or two Best of Class. So we're amongst the top 30 olive oil producers in the world now. To be listed alongside them is pretty good.
Now that is an achievement for little old Waiheke.
Yeah.
Well, for New Zealand too, of course. That's great. So now, how long have you had the olive grove?
We planted the trees, in 300 of them in 2000 and another 200 in 2001. We installed our olive mill in 2008, so we've been producing olive oil for ourselves and for other growers on the island for 5 years now.
Okay, so is that when you went commercial, as it were? Right.
Yes.
And are the olive trees all the same variety?
No, we have predominantly Tuscan cultivars, so that's Frantoio, Lacino, Pendolino, and those are the cultivars that we always... get awards for those, and also they're the most popular amongst our customers. But we also have Picual, which is a Spanish oil, beautiful oil, quite different from the Italian oils, and also a Greek oil, Koroniki. In fact, Koroniki is grown a lot on the island. We process a lot of Koroniki fruit for other growers, and Picual is also grown by some of the growers too. We think it's a wonderful oil because it's very high in polyphenols, which is the good antioxidants.
Oh, right. And which one was that?
Picual.
Picual, that's Greek, did you say?
Spanish.
Spanish, right, okay. Now, why is Waiheke such a good place to grow olives?
I think it's the insular climate. We're right on the coast, and so we get a lot of breeze through the groves, and the olives are pollinated by wind rather than by bees, so it needs that wind movement. There are groves that aren't on the coast that we manage as well, and they're producing beautiful fruit as well, but it's probably the wind and the fresh air and the climate and obviously the soil. So that the whole... aspect is known as terroir, so it's something that the wine industry talks about, and it applies equally to the olive industry.
Right, and the wine industry talks about north facing is better for the grapes. Does it matter which way the section faces for olives?
No, I mean our groves are in fact all facing south. Right. They slope down towards the sea. There are a lot of groves that are on the north side of the island. They just ripen at different times. We can't see a lot of difference in characteristics in the fruit, other than that ripening time. Further down the island, they're probably a couple of weeks later than they are up this end.
Right. Do you also grow olives for table olives, or just purely for oil?
No, we don't. We were buying in olives that we'd sell in the shop. We're not doing that now. Right. Most of our, in fact, all of our fruit is going into oil.
Right. You're listening to Island Life on Waiheke Radio, your community radio station, and we're talking to Kerry Hart from Azuro Grove and Tefal Point, who just won major international awards. They've got a gold and a best in class at an LA International Olive Oil Award. So that is a real feather in your cap, Kerry. We were talking about the aspect of the olive grove, of sloping down to the sea and that sort of thing. When I think of olive groves, I think of places like Greece and Spain, and that are dry and arid sort of land. And you could hardly say that about Tefal at the moment.
Definitely not.
So does that impact on the trees at all?
Yeah, it does. Every year we get it's a different climate, so our fruit's different, it ripens at different times, and the quality of the fruit is different. For example, last year, 2011, we had a lot of rain during autumn, and so the fruit didn't really ripen very well, and the yield in oil wasn't high. However, we had a lot of rain over summer this year, and then we had a beautiful autumn. It was fine and sunny, and the fruit ripened up beautifully. And those fruit characteristics came through. So I put it down to the fact that they got a lot of feed during the summer, and then we had that warmth that came during the autumn. And we started late. We were about 2 weeks later than we normally are because the fruit definitely wasn't ready. But we also made a conscious decision to pick some fruit a little bit earlier than we have done in the past because I wanted to get an intensity. And in fact, that gold medal we won was the robust class, and that the scores that we got in the tests from the lab indicated that was a robust oil, and that's what I wanted to achieve. So we did that through picking slightly earlier, but we got good oil yields. Nevertheless.
It obviously paid off.
Oh, yes.
Yes. When is the usual picking season?
Starts in April, goes through till early June on Waiheke. Mm-hmm. Throughout the rest of the country, some of them are still picking now. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the Hawke's Bay, they'd only just finished processing, and the fruit didn't have the oil content that we had here. In Canterbury, they got wiped out by the frost, so there was, in fact, no harvest in Canterbury. In Nelson, this year, they were very late, and I haven't heard what the results were like. But it just showed that Waiheke is obviously an ideal place because the warmth that we needed at that time of the year, with the temperatures, is going to give us, I think, a beautiful oil, and that's what's come through. I think the fruitiness in the oil is really great.
Mm. So making a good olive oil blend, would that be similar to making a good wine?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how the wine growers or the winemakers blend the different fruits. Certainly for us, what I've done this year is I've blended it during the processing rather than produce the oil. Say a cultivar like Frantoio and a cultivar like Licino, and then blend them afterwards, which is what I've done in previous years.
So you do that yourself?
Yeah.
You don't have an olive oil maker come in and do it?
No, I'm the olive maker, the oil maker.
Right. So how did you get into the business?
When we came here, we bought this property on Tefal Peninsula, beautiful spot. And I looked at it and I thought, well, what are we going to do with this? I talked to a few friends, they'd grown olives. But I noticed that they'd grown a particular cultivar that everybody said was going to do well here. And there were a lot of people who'd planted them. There were hundreds of this particular cultivar from Israel called Barnea. But they've turned out to be an absolute failure. So I studied what was happening here and also the climate, tried to compare the climate here with the climate in the Mediterranean. And I know it's different. It's nowhere near as hot here as it gets over there. But I felt that the Tuscan cultivars were the way to go, that we get good oil, and particularly from Frantoio, and that the other Tuscan cultivars would blend in well. So what I've done this year is I've actually chosen, as we've been picking groves, we've kind of mixed the pick, and I've processed that through the mill at the same time, so it's blended by the mill, not by me.
Okay, so when you started out, was it sort of trial and error, or did you go on a fact-finding trip somewhere?
No, we did that when we bought the mill. By then, we already had 500 trees in. But we had become quite passionate about olive oil, and we really enjoyed it. Bernie uses it a lot in cooking, and we could see the health benefits from it, and we just really got caught up in the industry, and we've been very passionate about our growing and our producing and our selling. I think that's paid off, because Bernie sells probably 90% of the oil through the shop, right. And every year she sells out the whole year's vintage, so we don't have any oil left over at the end.
Gosh, so if you want some of this award-winning olive oil, you better get in quick.
Azuro shop is at 152 Tifau Drive.
That's right. Yes, we're talking to Kerry Hart of Azuro Groves, who've just won an international award, a gold medal and a best in class for their olive oil. But of course, olive oil is not the only thing that you've got on your property. You've also got those lovely animals, alpacas.
Yes, they're gorgeous.
They are lovely animals, aren't they? And how did you do that? How did you get into that? Well, were they the lawnmowers, were they?
Yeah, they are now. Yeah. We were visiting a grove in South Australia, and we saw some alpacas there, and we thought, they're pretty good. It's not a bad idea, and then kind of forgot about it. And then we saw an ad that was in the local paper from Waiheke Alpaca. That's Keenan and Lisa Scott. And we went around and had a look, and when you see baby alpacas, oh, they're so cute. We were just taken. So we started off with 8. We've currently got 20, but at one stage we were close to 30. But they're gorgeous animals, and so they mow the grass around the groves. I don't have to mow it anymore. They provide fertiliser for our garden. We grow huge tomatoes because of that.
And they don't eat the olive trees?
They'll eat the leaves if there's no grass. So during the winter they'll have a crack at the trees, but the trees are big enough, and I prune them all those branches off later on. Right. They don't touch the olives. If there's olives on a branch, they'll eat around the olives, so okay. They're quite easy to pick, actually.
Are they high maintenance to look after, or are they pretty low maintenance?
No, pretty low maintenance. They're really good in terms of a soft-footed animal. They don't pug the ground. They're herd animals, they're easy to lead. I just walk in front of them and call them, and they'll follow me. The only thing I have to do is feed them every day. I just feed them a supplement, particularly during winter. They just eat a chaff and with some stuff mixed in it, and alpaca nuts. But the byproduct we get, of course, is from the fleece. We have that converted into yarn in a mill in Hastings, and then our neighbour, Bev Beetlestone, knits these beautiful garments, which includes baby clothes, which are probably the most popular line of the lot. We get a lot of grandmothers coming into the shop, and they head straight for the baby clothes.
Yes, it's a lovely soft fleece. My mum had a full-length alpaca coat, which was absolutely beautiful.
And they last too. I think that's lasted for years for you, hasn't it?
Oh gosh, yes. Yes, it's still sitting in the wardrobe. Unfortunately, it's not my size. But the alpacas, you don't... Does anybody use alpaca meat?
That's just started to happen in New Zealand.
Okay.
when an alpaca gets older, I mean, they live for 20 years, their fleece or the fibre will become coarse, and you really can't use that. So you can either sell them as pets or put them out as pets, but you really can't use the fibre for making garments. Mm-hmm. So there is, in fact, the mill that does the processing for us has just set up an abattoir in Hastings. But we couldn't imagine sending any of our boys or girls there, because...
No, I would think 20-year-old alpaca meat wouldn't really be that appetising.
No, I've never tried it, and I don't think I ever will.
No, not at all. Whereabouts did your alpacas come from? You bought them on the island, but were they imported from somewhere? Or were they born on the island? Or born and bred in New Zealand?
Well, most of them have been born at our place. In fact, I've delivered probably half of them. We originally bought them from Keenan, and he'd imported some of those from Australia. So most of the alpacas in New Zealand originated from Australia, or the breeding lines started there, but it's a big industry here now.
So could you imagine when you and Bernie first bought that property at Tifa that you'd end up delivering alpacas and making oil?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. It's very different from my day job.
Yes, you do have a day job. This is it. This is not your full-time employment, is it?
No.
Goodness me, you're a busy fellow. So do you get a bit of a downtime in the olive, between a seasonal down, and where you're not, you don't have to do too much of the trees and you're not making any oil and that sort of thing? Is there a period like that? And how long does that last for?
Yeah, well, most of the year, actually, there's not a lot to do. We do some nurturing just before spring. We obviously got the pruning's a big job, and... That's quite a big job, because it's not just our trees. We're managing about 2,000 trees all up, so that's quite intense. But I use some young Argentinian guys on the island to help me out on that. Then in autumn, in January, we also do a foliar spray, and apart from that, the trees are just looked after, and I just keep checking them, make sure that we don't have any problems with dieback and things like that, because occasionally you'll see an olive tree just looking sick. So I coppice it, and you'll find it'll regrow, and within 3 years it'll be producing fruit again.
Because they can live to a pretty ripe old age too, can't they? Pardon the pun.
Yeah, I just had lunch with a friend of mine who's a grower. He just come back from Italy, and he said he was trying to put his arm around an olive tree, and he had both arms stretched out, and he still couldn't touch either side.
Wow.
So that tree was probably 1,000 years old or more.
Crikey, yes.
You know, I've seen them in Italy that big too.
Would they still be producing?
Oh, yeah, because what they do is that they'll prune them. It's amazing. In fact, in Tuscany, we saw olive trees that had huge trunks, but the scaffold branches, which are the branches that the fruit's growing on, looked as though they were probably 2, 3, maybe 4 years old. Quite small branches.
Right, so they keep regenerating.
Oh yeah, they're as hardy as anything.
That's amazing. Yeah, well, Kerry, why did you come to Waiheke? What brought you here?
We came for a weekend. A lady that was that Bernie was working with had offered us her batch for the weekend. She said, oh look, the best views on Waiheke are on Te Whau Peninsula, make sure you go up there. So we went up there and had a look, and we saw this land, and we just fell in love with it. At the time we were living in Tuturangi, we'd been living there for 30 years, and we just said, hey, this is exactly what we want to do for the rest of our lives. We want to be here on this island, looking back at Auckland with pahutukawa trees right on the coast, be able to see the sea, and it was a magic environment, and that's what we've got.
Yeah, meant to be.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. We're talking to Kerry Hart from Azzurro Groves. Now, Azzurro, where did that name come from?
Azzurro means blue in Italian. When you stand on our deck or stand in the lounge and look out, you'll see blue sea, blue sky, and that's what it meant for us. Because we were growing Italian olive trees, we wanted to have that Italian flavour, And in fact, we've named all of the all the new cria, the baby alpaca that have been born on the farm, have all got Italian names.
Okay.
And it's something that we love Italian food, and our house was decorated with Italian furniture, and it just seemed appropriate.
Right. You mentioned earlier about the different species of
cultivars of
olives, and they come from Spain, Italy, Greece. Basically, you've got all those growing.
Yes.
And they do. They obviously blend together quite well.
Yes, they do. In fact, the Azzurro blend that we won these medals for is a blend of all of the cultivars that we grow.
So, right. Mm. So what other cultivars do you have, apart from Spanish, Italian and Greek?
That's it.
That's it. Oh, okay. So you don't have Israeli one now?
Well, in fact, we have... I kept about five of those just for... to provide a bit of a windbreak.
Okay.
Even hopeless at that.
So if you taste each of those olives separately, they have distinctive characteristics?
The oil would be, yes.
Right.
Some oil you'll find is more astringent, is will have a mouthfeel that's different from another one. The Koroniki, for example, has this amazing fragrance that when you taste it, it's like tasting wine, and you breathe in, you'll pick up a fragrance of geraniums or licorice, all sorts that seem to come through in that oil. When you're tasting, say, Frantoio, you'll get different taste sensations that come through in that. And that's we offer six oils in the shop, and people try them all, and it's amazing that we say, well, which one do you like? And sometimes he likes this one, she likes that one.
Mm.
So they'll buy both. we get a lot of kids coming into the shop tasting, and that's really quite encouraging, seeing kids tasting olive oil.
Mm.
And the kids decide which one they're going to buy.
Yeah.
So it's a palate thing.
It is a palate thing, and I remember trying one not so long ago. It wasn't one of yours, but it was nice on the mouth, but then it got to the throat, and whoa, it was very hot and peppery, and it was very quite overpowering. I don't know what sort of
that
would have been.
Well, it could have been picked too early, because if you pick too early and it's too green, you get that kind of intensity.
It did have a green sort of flavour to it, you know, an unripe flavour almost to it.
Yeah, but some people like that.
Yeah. Well,
I always say to people, you probably cough when you try this. One cough's good, two coughs even better, three coughs are great.
Okay, I'll try to remember that. But of course, it's like anything. It's like a wine. If you like it, that's fine. There's no rules about what you're supposed to like and what you're not supposed to like.
Not at all.
So and you can have a lot of fun trying the different varieties. But I've been talking to Kerry Hart from Azzurro Grove, Olive Grove in Tiefauer Point. And remind us again, Kerry, about this wonderful accolade that Azzurro has received internationally.
Well, the LA International Extra Virgin Olive Oil Competition is considered to be the most prestigious competition in the world for olive oil producers. And that's why producers from all over the world send their oil there. And we were just so rapt to win best of class and win a gold medal.
Right.
And we're the only ones in New Zealand to win that. Both of those was a huge buzz.
Absolutely. And which class did you win best of class?
It was robust.
Ah, right. And the gold medal?
Same oil.
Same oil, okay. Yeah. Do you have stocks of that oil?
Oh, yes.
So you haven't sold out yet?
Oh, no.
That's good. And it's available now at your shop?
Yes, it is. We sell it in 250ml bottles, but we also sell it in bulk.
Okay.
In the shop, we have 3-litre or 5-litre stainless containers with a tap, and we've got a few customers on Waiheke who just bring the container around and I'll fill it for them, so we have that available in the shop as well.
Okay. Now, how long would... What's the shelf like for... Shelf life for an oil like that?
2 years.
Okay. Mm. Once you open it.
Yeah, well, for a bulk oil, if you got it in this stainless container in the pantry, again, it'll last 2 years.
Right.
You just loosen the lid off, turn the tap on.
Right.
A bottle, as long as you put the cap on, it's still going to last. And that's one of the things about what determines an extra virgin olive oil. There's two factors. One is the free fatty acids have to be less than 0.5%, and the the peroxide value has to be less than 15. And we show those values on our labels.
Mm-hmm.
If they're above those parameters, then it's not extra virgin. If it is extra virgin and it's filtered, it will last 2 years. An unfiltered oil might only have a shelf life of 1 year, but we filter out.
Right. There's been some controversy lately about the commercial oils that we find on the supermarket shelves that say they're extra virgin when perhaps they're not. It's difficult to know, isn't it, when you go in there? How would a person like me who doesn't know anything about olive oil be able to tell whether it was the real deal or not?
Well, the first thing is you never buy olive oil that's in a clear glass bottle.
Okay.
Unless that clear glass bottle is in a carton. Right. But if you look at all of the supermarket olive oils, all the Lupi and so forth, they're in clear glass bottles. A lot of those oils are, in fact, a blend of some cases. They've found hazelnut oil in there that's been blended with a little bit of Italian olive oil. And the hazelnut oils come from Tunisia. There was a case recently where a tanker full of hazelnut oil was shipped over to Italy, pumped into an olive oil factory, a little bit of olive oil blended with it, and then it was sold as Italian extra virgin olive oil. And it's just a fraud.
It's also dangerous for people who've got nut allergies.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But it's dangerous also than a lot of that oil that's sold in the supermarkets. For example, Lite, L-I-T-E. People think, oh, that's low in calories, it's rubbish. A lot of that is produced using solvents. It's been extracted from the pomace, which is the byproduct when we produce the oil. So it's carcinogenic.
That's scary.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a huge rip-off. And, of course, the New Zealand Grocery Council is not supporting the labelling standards that have been adopted by Australia and New Zealand. So now, and the Australians have, but in New Zealand we haven't. And so the Australians are not able to sell that oil in the supermarket, so they're shipping it over here. And of course, one chain of supermarkets being Australian owned, we're having all that stuff dumped. And most consumers wouldn't have a clue. When they come into the shop and they try real olive oil and they say, I never knew olive oil could taste like this.
That's right. Now, is your olive oil too good to use for cooking?
Absolutely not. We use it all the time.
See, some people sort of feel that a really top quality olive oil should only be used for dipping or that sort of thing, but you don't use it in your everyday cooking. Save it for best, as it were. But you say, no, that's rubbish. Use it for cooking as well.
It enhances the flavour. We use it all the time. I mean, imagine lamb fillets. We do lamb fillets and lots of olive oil, lots of pepper, and sea salt across the top. The oil flavour will enhance the flavour of the lamb. We use it on vegetables done in the oven, just a layer of them on a baking paper on a tray, lots of olive oil, salt and pepper, a bit of garlic. The olive oil will enhance the flavour of those vegetables.
Right.
So one of the reasons that people say, you can't cook with it, is the smoke point. And I think this demonstrates that when you use the supermarket olive oil, it doesn't have a high smoke point because it isn't extra virgin olive oil, and in a lot of cases are not even olive oil. Whereas a an extra virgin olive oil, a good quality olive oil, has a high smoke point. And you won't get that same kind of smoking when the temperature gets high. But you should never use it for deep frying.
No, no. And when you talk about a high smoke point, does that mean that it could catch fire more easily than other oil?
Well, olive oil wouldn't.
No, okay.
But the counterfeit stuff, right. Who knows? Who knows what's in it?
Well, that's right, exactly. It's yeah. Now, your olive oil is on sale at your shop in Tiefauer. What number are you? You're easy to find, aren't you?
Yeah, 152. Just head out towards the vineyard. We're on the left-hand side.
Right.
152.
And is it available anywhere else?
It's available at Waiheke Fruit and Veg at the moment. And we are now also approaching some of the other outlets on the mainland. We pulled back from those last year because we didn't have the volume, because the season wasn't that good.
Right.
But now that we've got a lot more oil, we're starting to open up some new outlets. Also, our online site is starting to take off.
And what is that address?
That's at our www.zuragroves.com.
Okay, right. Oh, well, thank you, Kerry, for coming in. We've been talking to Kerry Hart from Azura Groves, who just won an international gold medal and a best in class for their olive oil, which is on sale at the moment at Azura Groves in Tiefauer Point. Thank you for coming in, Kerry, and all the best for the future.
Thank you, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Bye.
Island Life. Join us for your weekly catch-up with what people are doing and what people are thinking here on Waiheke. Issues, events, personalities and more. It's all here on Island Life, on Waiheke Radio, Saturday mornings 10 to 12. Brought to you by Placemakers Waiheke. Know how, can do.
And it's my very great pleasure to say good morning to Joe Holmes. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Jan.
Thank you for coming. Now, we've got some exciting news, I think. If you read the piece in the marketplace, we're getting $200,000 for roads.
Yeah, it's $200,000 we weren't anticipating at all. It's an extra $200,000 to spend just on Waiheke. It comes from a mayoral initiative, which asked for $10 million to be spread across all the 21 local boards. That we then had some conversation about how that should actually happen, and it was really gratifying in discussions with all the other local boards that they thought that Waiheke should have an extra weighting on the population. So if we had it on a straight population basis, I believe we'd have had about 50,000. But as it is, we've got 2%, which is 200,000. It's just fantastic.
Right. So in practical terms, what does that mean?
Who knows at this point, Jan? We've only recently had it confirmed, and the board has yet to meet to discuss what we might do with it. But I'm sure we'll find plenty of things.
Well, I'm sure you will. And I jokingly said to the lads, Al and Simon, on the breakfast show this morning that, hey, watch out for the superhighway between Mantiti and Onitengi. I said, I hope I'm not giving you ideas.
No, but there are plans ahead for the coming years to do some pavement rehabilitation work on Onitengi Strait. That's currently in the process right now. But that's an Auckland Transport initiative anyway, and something I think that's fully funded. So we won't be looking to spend it on that.
Right. Will there be any sort of opportunity for the public to make suggestions as to what the priority should be?
Absolutely, Jan. There are always opportunities for that. I'm really happy that people either phone me, email me, and indeed all the other board members would say the same. You just simply have to get hold of us, let us know what it is that you think that we should be spending that money on, and that would be really good to hear.
Right. Now, roading, does that just mean roads or does it mean other things as well?
It's in general, all the things that sort of fall under the auspices of Auckland Transport. So it could
be parking and footpaths.
It could be. It could be. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Now, I think some people were a little bit concerned when the local board decided not to go with the four well-beings, that is economic, social, cultural, environmental.
That's right.
Because they thought it would be better to go down the budgeting track. Now, does this mean, now we've got this money for the roads, does it mean that we're likely to get funding for things that come under those other headings?
The old four well-beings. Yeah. Well, they're still very much in the Auckland plan. The current Auckland plan has the four well-beings underpinning the things that are in the whole document and going for about 10 years. So it's really quite problematic at the moment. Remember, this is still the submission phase for the government, and they haven't yet brought into law the new proposed amendments to the Act. So the Auckland plan just carries on as it normally does under the four well-beings. We took the view as a board that it might be better to hear what the government was saying and work with them on just making some changes to that, which is what we were signalling when we said not quite that we didn't support the four well-beings, but we thought there was a better way of negotiating.
Right, so the possibility is there that the board could negotiate with the government to get funding for social things or cultural things.
The board doesn't negotiate with the government per se. This is a government initiative, and what we were submitting to was an Auckland Council submission to the government in its changes to the Act. So we have had a local board say on that, but by and large the submission is an Auckland Council one. Which will come from the governing body. They, because they really left it a wee bit late to consult us as local boards, we had to put our submissions in as extras onto the Auckland Council governing body submission.
Right, okay. So if the government goes down that track, it would be the board would make application to the Auckland City.
As I say, the reality of life is that the Auckland plan still encompasses the four well-beings, and it's all predicated on that. So there would have to be some negotiation between Auckland Council and the government in order for that to change the Auckland plan, which is now actually set out in stone, if you like, for the next 10 years as the visionary document for Auckland. So there's, you know, it's not straightforward. Mm. It's not straightforward, and there's obviously negotiation to come.
Right, okay. Now, we're, 2 years down the track?
Almost two years of the new
system. How is it working from your point of view?
Oh, well, I'm really encouraged. I wouldn't have said that just over a year ago. It was very early days. There was a lot of uncertainty, really, throughout the organisation. They didn't know quite what local boards were. We weren't quite sure of how the governing body co-governance model with local boards was going to work. So it's really been a work in progress. But there's been some very, very encouraging things over the last year. One of the most encouraging initiatives was actually from the Waiheke local board. We realised that when we were asked to give our authority, if you like, for the delegations to the chief executive, so that he could get on with his work and the officers get on with their work, that they required our signature to sign that off, and we said no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to sign off these delegations until the governing body gives some consideration to our requirements for delegations, so that we can meet those principles of subsidiarity which were implicit in the Act of forming the council. Right. And consequent to that, they have actually done that. We've been negotiating with them. We've had some good wins. We've got some more delegations. There's a long way to go. That's still a work in progress. But because of it, I think it's made perhaps the governing body and also the executive realise that we are here, that we need to be given a strong voice. We have a strong voice already, but that needs to have some actual powers behind it, and to take notice of us. And that's been so encouraging. And there's been a real change in attitude as a result of that.
Mm. Yes, that's a good thing to hear, because so often the bureaucrats in Auckland seem to be making the decisions rather than the people that have got the local knowledge.
I can assure you it's been a great battle on from our point of view as a board to try and make sure that our voice is the one that's heard. You can imagine there's been a real hiatus in people not quite knowing what's what, and we're kind of inventing it as we go along. So officers were sort of filling that gap while nothing was really certain, and we didn't think that was the right way at all, and we're gradually getting them to realise that working with us is absolutely the best way to go to get the best outcomes for everybody.
Absolutely. Well, I think that there have been occasions when decisions have been made by people in an office in Auckland who have never set foot on the island, and that is really
we're engaged.
Unfortunate.
But we're engaged with every part of council, and we get involved in all of the things that are going on. We increasingly are being involved in some of the wider issues that are being discussed, and that's all very encouraging.
Right. I have heard a couple of people say when they read that article about the funding for roads on the island, they said, "Oh well, that'll all go to the Esplanade," and because that's a bit of a hot potato at the moment, isn't it?
It is, but there's been no decisions at all about where the money's going to go. Auckland Transport have the responsibility now for making the resolutions of the board work and make them happen. And we haven't yet seen their plans for that. So,
yes, there have been some fairly fanciful figures going around about how much it would cost to do the Esplanade, and I think perhaps a little bit of emotion in there.
Well, Auckland Transport came to the board with basically three options. Keeping it as it was, closed and do nothing, truly wasn't an option for them, because the road is gradually eroding, going into the sea. The do nothing approach means that it will actually fall into the sea eventually. If Auckland Transport are to put money into it, then they have to. They are absolutely committed by their own, if you like, rules and guidelines to opening it for the best use for everybody, to all users. They cannot justify even beginning to spend nearly $2 million of ratepayers' money, which is what it's going to cost just to keep it in good repair right now, right this very second, for just a few users. It has to be open for everybody. And we heard that. We heard that loud and strong. But we're very keen at the option that did go for a shared space, which means that everybody can use it. The shared space concept means that the speeds along the Esplanade have to be very slow, between 10 and 30 kilometres an hour, that priority is given to the most vulnerable users. Motorists will have to respect that, and we would put in enough, if you like, traffic calming measures to make sure that it was a safe place for everybody.
Is it envisaged that it will be two-way or one-way?
The option that was recommended to us by Auckland Transport was a two-way road. The reason being that it's safer to have two-way traffic. One-way traffic encourages speeding of vehicles. If a vehicle feels that there's nothing coming the other way, then that's a kind of encouragement for them to speed. They said the safer option was two-way, and we supported that.
Right. Okay. We're talking to Joe Holmes, who's the transport spokesman on our local board. And we've been encouraged by the news that Auckland City is giving Waiheke $200,000 for roading and associated costs on the island. And Joe, you said no decision's been made yet, obviously, because it's too soon. But does that mean that the local board will meet and perhaps draw up a priority list, or firstly ask people to respond with their thoughts as to what the priorities will be, and then you approach. Do you have to go back to Auckland Transport, or do you have the money with no strings attached?
Yeah, no, this is a no strings attached piece of money. Most unusual in every other respect. At the end of the day, though, Auckland Transport are the people who actually have to deliver a project. We don't know yet whether that money is best split up among several projects, whether it's best to put it into one project. We as you say, you know, we need to have a look now at what projects perhaps have priority and do some prioritising. One of the things that we have to be conscious of with Auckland Transport involved is that there are possibilities of leveraging more money. So, you know, we might say something like, well, if we put in 100,000 into this project here, would you put in 300,000 to the same project? Mm-hmm. Well, they might say yes, you never know. But that is actually how they tend to work. If the local board shows willing on a project, they do try and leverage a lot of money from many different buckets that they have. Although there is one Auckland Transport, they have various areas of responsibility, like road safety might be an area, road corridor ops and maintenance might be an area, and so on and so forth. So they have the ability to look at their different budgets and say, well, this project can have some funding from there because it needs that, or some funding from there because it needs that. So this is how we can leverage and hopefully make our $200,000 go much further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you don't get if you don't ask.
That's right. That's it.
Yeah. Auckland Transport, they were set up about the same time as Auckland Council, weren't they?
They are. They're part of the new structure as a CCO, a council-controlled organisation. They sort of sit to one side, if you like, of the... a political entity, which is the governing body and local boards, but they are council-controlled organisations. However, they are established as limited liability companies and have that structure. It is a different entity. These are the people, if you like, water care, transport, regional facilities. These CCOs have a lot of the actual delivery of projects that they deliver to Auckland in general.
From your portfolio perspective, do you think it's working well with Auckland Transport?
I do. I am encouraged. It's just like I was saying at the beginning about the whole organisation. They too are a new entity. It's a different way of working for them. Many of the officers have come from the old way of working through Auckland Council. So they're still finding their feet as well. They're undergoing a lot of structural changes in the organisation, staff changes. Staff changes are a real problem across not only Auckland Transport, but in general across the new council. So they've taken a little while to understand how best to organise this new thing that they have control of. As they've been understanding that and got themselves more organised, we've noticed that definitely we have improving relationships with them. That's really what I've done, because in a time of uncertainty, it seemed to me that the only real progress that I as transport spokesperson could make was to establish relationships. And I've spent a lot of my energy in doing that, in trying to establish good relationships with the people at Auckland Transport so that we can talk to them about issues.
Mm. And you've also worked hard at establishing relationships on the island. You've had a couple of meetings with interested party groups.
Indeed. I mean, the Mātiatia conversation recently was something that we'd been asking for right from the beginning, in a way. I don't mean the conversation, but we had some concerns about all the plans that were in play under the previous Auckland City Council down at Mātiatia. Here we are in 2012, and most of those plans were drawn up 6 years ago. We had some concerns that the population has actually changed in its profile and its needs, so that we didn't want to have things just go ahead there without taking another look at what might be achieved down there and what is perhaps more appropriate for what we have now than even 6 years ago. So Auckland Council Properties and Auckland Transport have control of the land down there. And they were, they, as I said before, they as CCOs have their own priorities. And we wanted to make sure when they were looking at those areas that we also had a say in what was going to go on down there. We did. They saw that was in our plan. They said, well, look, we are having a look at everything. So that seemed to me an appropriate time to get a real community conversation going.
Right. One of the problems down at Martiti that I've observed is that it's not one entity that has responsibility for it. There's about three or four councils. And from my observation, I don't think they even talk to each other.
You've got two things. That's what we're saying about the whole organisation, getting it to talk to one another. It is actually happening. It is starting to get better. Yes. But you've got different. Although it's still Auckland, we have to understand, it's still Auckland Council. So although you've got Auckland Council properties who have responsibility for a lot of the land down there, and some of the land is now the responsibility of Auckland Transport, they do talk to one another, and we need to talk to them. So there is some coordination now starting to happen, but I agree with you, Jan. I think there's been just piecemeal changes made. A lot of the changes that were made at the beginning were as a result of resolutions that had been passed by the Auckland previous City Council, very close to the end of the time of the last council. So they were just, you know, cracking on, and we wanted to say, "Whoa, hold your horses there!" Mm. So we're starting to get somewhere with that, and that's what this Martiti conversation is about.
That's good. Now, does the community board or the local board rather have any input into what is being planned for the other side, for the ferry tee at Auckland, where they want to rehash it all and make Quay Street a mall and all that sort of thing?
We have submitted many times on the need to keep Britomart as our transport hub. I think the words I use were, you have to, this is to the governing body. The governing body, by the way, for people who don't understand it, is the mayor and councillors. And we as local boards sit alongside them as the political entity for Auckland Council. I was very keen for them to understand that Britomart, as our transport hub, is a lifeline. And I use that absolutely seriously. We have many people going to hospitals in Auckland. If their transport connections are not preserved, then we really lose out hugely, and we can't afford that. So we have said that really strongly, and I went last night to the launch of the Auckland City Master Plan and Waterfront Plan documents. And we sat in the front row and eyeballed Ludo Campbell-Reed, who's the urban designer, if you like, as part of this. And I'm pretty sure that when he was talking about how exciting Quay Street is going to be as a more pedestrianised precinct, he looked our way and quickly added, but of course, we will keep transport cars and everything else going up and down in an east-west route. And I thought, yes, you will. You will.
That's good to know. Yes, because that can be a real problem there. And even since they reconfigured on the Queen's Wharf side for the World Cup, that's just changed that area to the detriment, I think, of being able to stop and drop off and pick up.
I agree. I think it's a real concern, and it's something we're taking up and have taken up with Auckland Transport. Don McKenzie has been particularly instrumental in trying to get them to understand the difficulties that people have with disabilities and of an ageing population, which is what we actually have on Waiheke. And they're truly not making the best of the possibilities that exist right now of transport connections at the wharf itself.
Mm. The thing is, of course, that we don't really learn from history, because when the plan for Britomart was first drawn up, there was going to be an underground and walkway from the ferry to the trains and all that sort of thing. Mm. And that would have been absolutely brilliant.
Yep, it would. Yeah. It absolutely would. And it's still not there, and that's a real concern for us. But an even bigger concern is that they stop thinking of it as a transport hub for people, not only of Waiheke, but also of Devonport.
Mm.
You know, they are very much in the same sort of, I mean, obviously they have facilities over there on the North Shore, but nevertheless an awful lot of people from Devonport commute, and they still need those transport connections.
That's right. Well, there are an awful lot of ferries operating now from all around the
place. And they want more.
Even from, you know, the upper harbour and...
absolutely, and the plan is that there should be more ferry connections, not less.
Mm.
So we're pleased to see that some money is apparently being set aside to do work on Pier 1. But we want to try and make sure, and we have said loud and clear, that the facilities that we have on Pier 2 are currently inadequate to... Mm. They're really not fit for purpose.
Mm.
It's windy, it's cold, it's horrible, it's wet. It's really not a good place to be. So, again, we're pushing with Waterfront, which is another CCO, a different CCO, to get them to consider our needs whenever they're doing their forward planning.
Right. Well, that would be that'd be great. And Joe, we appreciate the work you're doing there.
Thank you.
You seem to be enjoying your portfolio.
I am.
Yeah.
I have to say, even much to my own surprise, I really do enjoy it. And not only my portfolio, but working on the board. You know, we have a really good team. We work well together. I think we've already made some real differences to the island. It's fantastic that the library project will soon, fingers crossed, actually be going ahead with somebody turning a sod, as they say. But that is due to happen soon. So, but you have been saying that for the last 2 months, so it's getting a bit wearisome. But it will happen, and we've managed to secure a lot of funding for that project. You know, so it's really a $7 million project now. And we'll be getting a library which is twice the size of the current library. So really an exciting time.
Yeah, and of course our library, I think, deserves everything it gets because it's so proactive and it's really good for the island.
It's fantastic. I mean, they're also, we had a briefing with them just the other day, and they're looking at the new facilities that we will have, something that we've asked them to really consider strongly, which kind of isn't in the mix at the moment, but could be still, we hope, is an introduction of an ultra-fast broadband hub there. Mm-hmm. As we've been told, that is actually delayed now for the island between 2 and 5 years hence, when we thought it would be much sooner.
Mm.
So we're really pushing now for some facility for people, and the library seems to be the best place for it. New facilities, they can really do good things there.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Joe. We've been talking to Joe Holmes, the transport spokesman for the local board, and thank you very much for coming in, Joe.
Thank you, Jan. It's always a pleasure.
Good work.
It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.